confirmation that a compact antenna made out of low loss material can give you full performance. The significant chapter in the first edition of the book by, I can't think of his caller, it was also W-H-A-K, John Krause. John Krause wrote a book called Antennas. He's from the, I keep calling it Ohio University, it's Ohio State University. He wrote a real good book, McGraw-Hill, 1950, called Antennas, and in there he said, an infinitesimal antenna, an infinitesimal dipole, gives you full performance. You never lose more than half a dB when you take a dipole down to some ridiculously small size. Can we drop? In the old days, before we started using antenna tuners, we had to make the antenna physically resonant in order to give you a low standing wave ratio. That's no longer true. You can now take a dipole on 80 meters, which normally is 132 feet of wire, and shrink it down to 32 feet of wire if you want. If you were feeding that antenna directly, you'd want to use an open wire line because you're running an extremely high standing wave ratio. A 32-foot antenna dipole on 80 meters probably has a 100-to-1 standing wave ratio. But if you've got a large enough tuning range of your antenna tuner, you can resonate that antenna with open wire and open wire feed line, and you'll get within half a dB the same performance you would get with the full 132-foot antenna. There's a zillion kinds of antennas, compact loops, and dipole-like antennas where the wire itself is helically wound, loading coils, top hat capacitors, and so on. If you do some research by way of the antenna book from ARRL and also internet site, let me drop. You do a search for compact antennas, you'll find a lot of information. Just because you've shrunk the antenna down 4-to-1 in size doesn't mean it has 4-to-1 or 16-to-1 difference in effective capture area. As long as it's resonated by way of your antenna tuner or the other techniques, as I said, helical winding, zigzagging it, top hat capacitors, loading coils, and so on. There's a whole bunch of ways you can make an antenna compact, re-resonate it, and even if you don't re-resonate it, as long as you've got a large enough tuning range to your antenna tuner, you can force it into resonance. So once it is electronically resonated with an antenna tuner, or physically resonated with those other things I described, helical winding, zigzagging, loading coils, top hat capacitors, combinations of all of that, and the loop antennas with multiple turns to the loop. As long as you're using low-loss material, the antenna can be running 95% efficient and give you full performance, even though it's physically small. Let me drop. You do suffer one disadvantage when you make an antenna compact and run it in the apartment with you. It becomes very high in Q, very narrow band. So if it's resonated at the 3.85 megahertz, for instance, on the 80 meter band, 3850, and then you move 50 kc up or down, it'll take retuning of the antenna tuner, you'll develop a high standing wave ratio. It'll become narrow band. That's the one disadvantage of being compact. But as long as you've made it resonate on your favorite frequency, the fact that it's compact doesn't hurt you at all. And one other thing, of course, don't operate this compact antenna 5 feet away from you and put a kilowatt into it when the antenna is in the apartment with you. Make sure there's at least 10 feet of distance between you and the antenna if you're running high power. If you're running QRP, don't worry about it. So once you do some research, you'll find out that the amount of signal that gets into your apartment, you can fully absorb that as if the antenna were full size, as long as you're willing to live with narrow bandwidth with these compact antennas. As I said, everyone believes when you physically make the antenna small that its effective capture area is small, its gain is going to be small, and so on. Absolutely not true. And you can build all kinds of small antennas and do receiving with them, and if you build them out of the right materials, you can transmit through them and get full performance. So the fact that you don't have an external antenna is a slight disadvantage, but as long as you've got the right attitude and do enough research, you'll be amazed what you can do with internal compact antennas. Over to you, Bob. KD2 NVB, wait for the beeps. K2LIW in the tech net.
Thanks, Dick. Yeah, I was just thinking of the narrow band. Can that be compensated for if I want to invest in, I guess, what they call automatic antenna tuners that you can hook to the radio? That's one question. The other question is, any radio I get at this stage is not going to be more than 100 watts. So is that how, like, what the stage distance could be from the antenna when I'm, let's say, 100 watts? Over to you.
When the antenna is compact, any antenna that's not a Yagi or something with a whole lot of area, like a great big dish, or something with a whole lot of elements, like a Yagi, any simple dipole-like antenna, you can make a simple assumption that it has a nearly omnidirectional pattern. Yeah, there's going to be a null off the edge of the wire. If the wire is strung east-west, then directly east and directly west, you'll have a null in the pattern. The dipole tends to radiate broadside. East-west piece of wire gives you the strongest signal north and south. So, except for that narrow null you've got off the tip, you can assume the antenna is omnidirectional. Now, an omnidirectional antenna with 100 watts into it, or a light bulb with 100 watts into it, is going to give you the same number of watts per square meter, if you know what I mean. By way of, you can calculate the surface area of a sphere. A light bulb in the middle of a spherical room, if the spherical room has 100 square meters of area to it, and you're putting 100 watts into that light bulb in that spherical room, then obviously the power hitting the walls of the room are going to be 1 watt per square meter, if you know what I mean. So you can make that simple calculation, and you can therefore figure out how many watts per square meter is your body going to get. Let me drop. In the old days, 10 milliwatts per square meter was considered the threshold of alarm for radio exposure. Nowadays, they've lowered it to 1 milliwatt per square meter, just to be conservative. But that's only true for frequencies, the VHF frequencies, 30 to 300 megacycles. 30 to 300 megacycles, the body absorbs all of the RF that hits it and turns it into heat. And it's the heat that you're worried about. All other non-thermal effects of RF they don't exist. They've been looking for them for years. It doesn't exist. On the HF frequencies, 30 megacycles and down, below 30 megacycles, a high percentage of the energy passes through without being absorbed. So probably 10 milliwatts per square centimeter, which is around, I think that turns out to be, let me think now, 10 to the 4. That would be 100 watts per square meter. Yeah, 100 watts per square meter is, let's call it 10 watts per square meter. That would be 1 milliwatt per square centimeter. 10 watts per square meter is the threshold of alarm for 30 to 300 megacycles. Below those frequencies, you need to go to a higher number. So it's an easy calculation. And my guess is you're extremely safe at 10 feet of distance between you and that antenna. But you can recalculate that by the means that I just given you. So, don't operate it with right alongside of your head. And by the way, let me drop. The most vulnerable part, let me drop a little longer. I sure wish that the CW sign in the long version, W2VL is the short version, W2VL/R, Long Island, New York. I wish the long version didn't, there's some way of killing that during the net because it's an awful long wait, if you know what I mean. The thermal energy, the most vulnerable part of the human being is the eye. The eye has a thermal time constant of 6 minutes. So the amount of heat is given to your eye in 6 minutes, 6 minutes is what counts. So even if you exceed the watts per square meter, and you're only transmitting 1 minute at a time and then listening for 2 minutes, if you know what I mean, you have to figure out what's the total amount of heat you're giving your body in a 6 minute period. And a safe number, in my opinion, is 1,000 watts per square meter. When the sun shines on you, when you're lying on the beach, the sun is giving you, 1,300 watts per square meter is what the sun is giving you on a sunny day if the sun is shining directly on you. And the body can take that amount of heat as long as you've got the normal cooling going on. So it gives you some of the ideas of what you can tolerate. My guess is 10 feet is going to be safe for most situations. Bob, Kilo Delta 2, November Victor Bravo, K2I, W in the TechNet.
Okay, so if I have I had a dipole, let's say on the perimeter of my ceiling, and my view is probably over my head in my room, so I guess it would be less than 10 feet, because it would be 6 feet. It's better from the ceiling. It's going to be fine from my height, sitting in a chair, maybe 6 feet. But I could put, if I had another kind of antenna headed by my window, that might be about 10 feet. And I was wondering, at the beginning, I'm just going to be using it, I'm going to get an all-in-one kind of radio, so at the beginning I'm probably just using a 2 meter 440, because I may have a magma in my refrigerator, a quarter-wave magma, you know, half a meter long, a quarter-wave of 2 meters. So that, at the moment, I'm like, this may be 8 feet for me, and I'm talking about either 35 or 50 watts doing, you know, either VHF or 35 watts on UHF is a probable thing. So the one that's about 80 on 50 or 35 watts, but it's VHF, UHF. So does that sound pretty safe?
Yes, it does sound pretty safe. And when it comes to a dipole, Bob, everyone thinks that a dipole has to be a straight piece of wire parallel to the ground. Absolutely not. You can zigzag it up and down, left and right, all kinds of ways, and you'll get 95% of the performance, even though when you've done that. So the dipole doesn't have to be straight out. At your operating position, you can make a great big bend in the dipole so that the dipole doesn't come near to you, if you know what I mean. You can zigzag it in various ways, run it around the perimeter of the room and so on. That combined with the fact that you're integrating over 6 minutes, and rarely are you going to make a key down transmission for 6 solid minutes, if you know what I mean. And if you're running sideband, the average power you're transmitting is only there when you've got the heavy speech processing and you're saying ah with your voice. And so the average power in a sideband transmission is a hell of a lot lower than you think it is. It's not the peak envelope power that counts. It's the average. You've got a whole lot of factors in your favor here. Zigzagging and bending in various ways. So that's and it's the center of the dipole where the high current is flowing, where the strongest field is coming from, in my opinion. The tips of the dipole is where there's high voltage, and the amount of heating that creates to your body is a hell of a lot less near the tips. Let me drop. So a little bit of research, you're going to find out there's lots of ways you can make compact antennas that fit inside of your apartment. Now, when it comes to automatic tuning, in order to try to recover the very narrow bandness of the antenna, that's going to work up to a point. I'm a little disappointed by the fact that how broadband if your antenna is going to hit, because it's super compact, a 30 to 1 standing wave ratio, will your antenna tuner be able to handle that? The answer is yes and no. At certain phase angles, in other words, a certain dot on that Smith chart with a 30 to 1 standing wave ratio, your antenna tuner can handle it. But will it handle the whole circle of 30 to 1? Probably not. I'm disappointed by the fact that people who manufacture antenna tuners, I wish they would give you a Smith chart where they color in the portions of the Smith chart where the antenna tuner will handle it for you. And it's not a simple circle, if you know what I mean. It's a very complicated pattern that you get as to what standing wave ratio and what part of the chart with high standing wave ratio the antenna will cover. Let me drop. However, by various means, you can find out that your particular antenna tuner will tolerate a 30 to 1 standing wave ratio as long as it's a purely inductive or purely capacitive, so to speak. And therefore, with your antenna analyzer or a calculation, knowing the physical characteristics of your antenna, you can find out what is the standing wave ratio? You can calculate by way of the Brown and Woodward curves. You can find out exactly what your dipole is doing, what its impedance is. Therefore, with the right length of transmission line, you'll rotate that impedance on the Smith chart to the so-called good area of your antenna tuner. So there's various ways around this. And once again, even if your antenna tuner can't handle it and you don't want to add the extra transmission line, you can add an L network, an inductor and a capacitor, a hand-wound coil with a transmitting range capacitor with it. You can correct the impedance of your antenna at your favorite frequency. So there's a lot of solutions to this problem. I didn't say they're super easy, but for a person like you who's willing to do the research, there's a lot of ways you can make a compact antenna fit into your apartment, give you full performance, and operate at the frequencies you care about. KD2, November Victor Bravo, K2RIW. Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, thanks, Dick. I have the, on my Kindle version of, it's called Small Antennas for Small Spaces, and if I understand correctly, I could correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's a subset of the antenna book, for antennas that would probably apply to me for small spaces. Now, maybe it's not a complete subset, if it isn't, let me know, maybe I should buy the antenna book. Yeah, so I have read some of that, and I got ideas. It seems like the general wisdom, and I've asked Roy this actually before, and I've read things, that I guess a dipole of some sort is my best bet. So I guess there are loops and other things, and I'll keep researching this. So anyway, thankful again, and anything else you can add that, and the other thing is that you get the big antenna book, like, if the small antennas for small spaces is not a complete subset of those types of antennas, or maybe I just learned some other things from the antenna book that would help my situation. Over to you.
KD2AMZ with a comment.
I think that's you, Mike. Don't want to make a comment? Go right ahead, Mike.
Yes, Nick. When I was stationed down in Virginia, I was in an apartment building and had similar problems, but I've had excellent results. What they call the MFJ apartment antenna. It wasn't perfect, but it worked. And yes, it was high Q, but I had to retune it all the time, and I had a tuner with the counterpoises running underneath my rug and a 17-foot antenna, which I took in and out to work HF. Let me let it drop. And when I wanted to work UHF, VHF, I used a Slim Jim J-pole type antenna. Whipped the antenna, just dropped out the window, or most of the time was just taped to the window. So it's very doable to operate in an apartment. I did it for almost 3.5-4 years.
Yeah, that's good information, Mike, and thank you. ARL book on small antennas for small spaces, I believe it contains a greater number of small antennas than the big book. So does the big book have more information on this subject? I think the answer is no. However, the big book is a good thing to own because it's a lot of other information in there. You'd be amazed how many people who work for a major commercial or military organization as an antenna designer. You'd be amazed how many of those people have the ARRL antenna book on their work bookshelf. Quite often it's turned around backwards. In other words, the spine of the book is not aimed out to, because they don't want to advertise that one of their major textbooks happens to be a ham radio book, but it's one of the most useful books in the world from my point of view. So you've already got a very good book on the subject. You'll have to do some experimenting, but you'll get full performance. The hard thing to believe is that an infinitesimal dipole, according to Krauss's book, the first edition, the 1950 edition antennas, an infinitesimal dipole gives full performance. You never lose more than half a dB if you've made it out of low-loss material. And by the way, if you have any fear about whether or not your antenna with your method of construction has extra loss, let me drop. The only mechanism by which, let me drop long enough. The only mechanism by which it can have extra loss is by turning some of your RF energy into heat. If it gets hot, it's got some loss. But you'd be amazed how sensitive this particular test is. Take whatever antenna you're suspicious of, put 5, 10, or whatever watts into it for a couple of minutes, turn off the power real fast and run over there and touch everything. If it runs ice cold, it doesn't have any loss. If you're putting 10 watts into an antenna, and if it's mildly warm to the touch of your hand, that might represent 1 watt of loss. 1 watt of loss out of 10 watts is something like half a dB, if you know what I mean. That test is very sensitive. So any substantial amount of loss will show up as heat right away. If it runs cold, it's running at near 100% efficiency. Therefore, every watt you put into it is being radiated into space, and it's giving you full effective capture area. It develops that full capture area by way of high Q. High Q means energy is bouncing back and forth more times because of the high Q, and that's where the high current is coming from in the center. That gives you the strong magnetic field that gives you the radiation. So you have a slightly higher rise time and fall time, but that's in microseconds. Don't worry about it. But you have a more narrow bandwidth with a compact antenna. But with the right kind of tuning techniques, you can accommodate that. So go to it, as I see it, Bob. And by the way, as you run these experiments and as you do this research, come back periodically and tell us what you find and how well it's working. Kilo Delta 2, November Victor Bravo, K2RIW. You got it, Bob.
Thanks, Dick. And on the general, I forgot his name, call sign. He suggested the MFQ apartment antenna. I assume I can look that up on Google and find some more detailed information about it. Wonder if we can get an answer to that. I'm guessing, I'll try it and I'll see if I don't get an answer. There's probably many more questions I can ask, but right now my mind is stuck. I'm not thinking of any specifics. So, I guess you're thinking of loops. I mean, they're easy. You stick them in the window, but they're probably not as good as a dipole. Is that correct in general? I know that's a very general kind of question. Over to you.
Hey, MC, let me answer that, Dick.
Yeah, I'm going to pass it over to Mike to give you those references in a minute. Lots of people believe that a light loop is lower in performance than a dipole. Absolutely not true. If you build a loop out of low loss materials, it'll give you 95% efficiency. You build your dipole, compact dipole, out of low loss materials, it'll give you 95% efficiency, if you know what I mean. So people believe a loop is lower in performance. It's an old wives' tale, not true. Over to you, Mike, and give him the references he's looking for. You got it, Mike. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KD2MZ. It's in the MSJ catalog. It's called the apartment antenna. They have two versions. I think it's from 40 to like 10 or 6 and like 80. The 80 has a loading coil. I use the one with the 80 meter version. It's got a tuner. The tuner is a double tuner. One tunes the antenna and the other one tunes the counterpoise or the ground, the RF ground. That's another whole subject. But you tune the RF ground and you tune the antenna. And it is a high Q, and it worked very nicely for me. Again, it wasn't perfect, but it worked very nicely, and that is for HF. For UHF, a simple, cheap J-pole type of antenna. They sell them on eBay for like 15, 16 bucks. It's called the Slim Jim antenna. It's flexible, and you can tape it to your window. I had excellent results living in an apartment, and I was on the second floor, but in reality, it was on the third floor. So this system will work. MFJ apartment antenna. Again, but you got to be careful. You got to make sure everything's right, or you're going to get bit. Dick, you can explain what I mean when you can get bit from your radio.
Yeah, when you make the antenna compact, it will be higher in Q. Q has got about five different meanings. antenna frequency divided by bandwidth. You're going to get a high number. It's a fancy way of saying it's a narrow band antenna. Another definition of Q is current rise at resonance and voltage rise at resonance. So the voltage at the tip of a compact antenna is going to be a higher voltage. That's not dangerous, but if you touch the antenna while you're transmitting, you may get a small arc over to your finger. Not dangerous, but uncomfortable, if you know what I mean. Rise time, energy stored per cycle, energy dissipated per cycle, that's another definition of Q. Voltage rise, current rise, bandwidth, and rise time and fall time. They sound like five different ways of measuring it, the exact same phenomena, just five different ways of assessing it. The belief that people have that a loop antenna has lower efficiency or lower performance is not true. If you look at the pattern you get out of a, if the plane of your loop is perpendicular to the ground, it's a vertical loop if you know what I mean, it's got the exact same pattern as a half-wave dipole. And the half-wave dipole, when you make it compact, the lobes become a little bit broader. That's where the half a dB of lower gain comes from. It's not a half a dB of lower efficiency. A half a dB of lower gain broadside to the antenna because the lobe is broader. So don't let people tell you that a loop is lower in performance. And whether or not, and now, one other thing I was going to tell you about artificial ground. Let me drop. If your antenna is a symmetrically fed antenna, like a dipole, properly fed with an open wire line and a balancing device, at one instant at a time, you're pumping positive current into the right-hand side and negative current into the left-hand side during that half cycle of the RF, and then the opposite on the other half cycle. Fully balanced antenna requires no ground. That dipole, that compact dipole, properly fed, could be operated by an astronaut while he's in orbit 200 miles above the Earth. No local ground, and it'll give him full performance. The only place where you need a local ground, if it's a non-symmetric antenna, an end-fed wire, so to speak, there you might need an artificial ground or a counterpoise of some kind. But if you choose a symmetric antenna, properly fed loop antenna is symmetric. Properly fed dipole antenna is symmetric. Requires no ground, RF ground, or no ground of any kind, other than the grounding you do for power safety. You'd like your equipment to be properly grounded so that if there's a wiring error, let me drop. If there's a wiring error inside your transmitter, so that the chassis of the antenna becomes hot with a 110 volt line, if you don't have the proper grounding to correct that, that'll blow a fuse or open up your circuit breaker, that could be dangerous. So for human safety and or lightning protection, grounding is required. But RF grounding is a controversial subject. Some people think that without proper RF grounding, you're going to get more television interference. Usually not true. You think you're going to get a higher standing wave ratio. Usually not true. So you only need an RF ground if it's a non-symmetric antenna. Like a quarter wave ground plane is a non-symmetric antenna if you don't have a great big counterpoise. And the counterpoise on 80 meters would be pieces of wire that are 65 feet long. And in an apartment, you can't do that. So as long as you choose a non-symmetric, as long as you choose a symmetric antenna, I don't think you need an RF ground. But let's see if Mike's got some further opinions on this. Over to you, Mike. It's AMW, K2LIW.
You're absolutely correct. In a symmetrical antenna, you're good. It's when you have a non-symmetric, like, Calorana Wyndham or anything like that, or even this apartment. This apartment antenna is a non-symmetric antenna, and it needs a counterpoise. It comes with various counterpoise wires and a counterpoise or an artificial ground tuner, which it creates the counterpoise. This, for an apartment, is, you have that problem. I was actually able to operate 80 meters out of my apartment with this antenna system. But high Q, I had to tune the antenna tuner section, and I had to tune the ground section, so I had maximal ground current, RF ground current, and vice versa. So, yes, you are 100% correct. This antenna is a good compromise for an apartment. I loved it. It was my savior. For UHF, VHF, keep it simple. Just use a J-pole. You can't go wrong.
Very fine, Mike, and I thank you. Bob, do you need any fills on any of the information we've just given you? Go ahead and ask right now. Kilo Delta 2, November Victor Bravo. K2RIW in the TechNet.
I think that's a lot of information for me to process and look up. I was just, so I guess it's some kind of a J-pole. I mean, right now, I guess I'll suffice with this. I have this refrigerated, as I mentioned before, it's an egg mount. It's a quarter wave, so 2 meters, maybe a half meter long. So I guess the J-pole would be superior to that. And I'm wondering, even in on the magnetron level, if it would be maybe getting one that's more like a half wave or a 5/8 wave, that would be substantially better than a quarter wave, or I shouldn't even mess with it. Is this magnetron going to be even passively good until I find something else? For, I'm talking about UHF, VHF now. Over to you, and I'm probably winding down, unless you're answering, of course, for more questions for me, but I don't want to skip all the time here. Over to you, Dick.
A mag mount antenna, quarter wave versus 5/8 wave, is a dB or two of difference in gain. That's rather minor. A quarter wave mag mount on, let's say, 450, put on top of a refrigerator, where the sheet metal of the refrigerator is the counterpoise, that can give you full performance, as if you're putting it on the roof, the sheet metal roof of an automobile. People have some nasty comments about mag mount antennas, the fact that it's not physically grounded. Well, the magnet on the bottom of the antenna with a thin piece of plastic below it gives you very high capacitive coupling to the sheet metal of the automobile or the sheet metal of your refrigerator. And that gives you a beautiful RF ground. That's all you need. And do some experimenting as to whether or not the mag mount for your particular favorite repeater. Does it work better when the mag mount is in the center of the refrigerator or off to one side, or when you mount it on the side of the refrigerator? Polarization is a peculiar characteristic in an urban environment. When that signal reflects off of all the buildings and water towers and downspouts and wiring in the building and everything else, even though the repeater itself is purely vertically polarized, by the time that signal gets to your apartment, there's a slim chance it arrives horizontally polarized. Let me drop it. So do some experimenting as to where you mount it, on the top of the refrigerator, on the side of the refrigerator, to the left side, the right side, high, low, and so on. This repeater is a purely vertically polarized transmitting antenna. However, when that signal gets to my house in Huntington, into my bathroom, if the signal is primarily horizontally polarized, I mount my handy-talkie horizontal on a plastic shelf in my bathroom in order to get the strongest signal from this repeater. So a compound bounce off of metallic objects at a crazy angle can shift the polarization of the signal. You'd be amazed how many people don't know that. So a 2 meter mag mount, even the refrigerator, the sheet metal refrigerator, is probably big enough even for 2 meters. I'll admit that a 6 meter mag mount on a refrigerator might need a little bit more ground plane, if you know what I mean. But 2 meters and 450 for sure. And whether or not you use a quarter wave or a 5/8 wave, that's a minor detail from my point of view. There's a dB of difference there. And you can get 5 dB of difference, 10 dB of difference, just by shifting the position of the mag mount on your refrigerator when listening to that particular repeater, because multiple propagation is everywhere. That signal is bouncing off of every object in your apartment, even the non-metallic objects, and all those signals are being combined when you're receiving at the antenna, all being combined in a vector manner. Let me drop. If you listen to a weak repeater with your handy-talkie, and you shift your handy-talkie in your living room, left, right, up, down, forward, and back, and shift it in polarization, tilt to the left, tilt to the right, while you're moving it around. You'll find certain positions where the signal disappears and certain positions where the signal is strong. Why is that happening? Multipath. All those signals are bouncing off of everything in your environment, and at certain positions of your handy-talkie, all those signals come out in phase, and you get an enhancement. In other positions, the signals come out of phase, and you get a cancellation. So you get a beautiful demonstration of multipath when you are listening to a weak repeater, and you shift the antenna X, Y, and Z in both position and polarization, and find out where the signal peaks up. And sometimes it peaks in funny ways. And also, there's one other crazy characteristic. When you find the strongest signal on reception, it's not necessarily the strongest signal on transmission, because the transmission is a slightly different frequency. And by the time that signal travels those hundreds of wavelengths between you and the repeater, that little bit difference in frequency makes it all add up differently. Let me drop. So sometimes you'll shift the handy-talkie to the strongest position for reception, and then you transmit back to that repeater, and people say you're noisy. You have to find the other position for the strongest signal on transmission. Over to you for any other comments on all of the above, Bob. KD2, November, Victor Bravo. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, okay, thanks, Dick. I don't want to take up too much. I've already been taking up a lot of time here, so. I guess it doesn't matter too much. I got other things on the refrigerator shop. Most of them are not metal, but I can move it if that's not good. And it's a fruit bowl of dice, especially a metal dish. And I'm not sure it's kind of metal. It's not magnetic metal. But anyway, yeah, I just was thinking like food storage containers that I'm not using at the moment. I'm storing them on top. So I think I've been told before that that doesn't matter too much. I'm talking about the top of the fridge, that's the complaint. And that's about it. As far as grounding, I think my best bet is cold water pipes. And I've been told, that boy told me that it's probably as good as I got. That's probably fine. So over to you, and that's about it for me, and I can let you move on. Quick answer to those two things. Otherwise, thanks so much, and I will be listening.
As far as the other metallic objects on top of your refrigerator interfering with the reception of the antenna, the answer is very unlikely, although you can run an experiment and find out real fast. Objects that are near an antenna, as long as they're not a resonant length object, their radar cross-section, so to speak, is a very small number most of the time. Even another antenna, if you've got two mag mounts on the refrigerator, one for 2 meters and one for 450, believe it or not, they almost do not see each other, because only at resonance does the wire have a significant effective capture area. So when you're on 450, that 2 meter antenna, even though it's on the third harmonic, is primarily not resonant. Particularly when you're on 2 meters, the 450 antenna is not there. And other metallic objects, as I said, as long as they're not resonant, no problem. And there was a second subject you had on that list. Second question. Objects, grounding, water pipe. Water pipe makes a very good ground as far as human safety is concerned. Con Ed and LIPA and PSE&G type grounding for human safety. RF, water pipe is a good RF ground if you're on 80 meters and you've got a non-symmetric antenna. The water pipe makes a good ground. But as long as you're using a symmetric antenna, you require no RF grounding. So good luck with all of that, Bob. Let us know in the future weeks what you find when you do your research and when you do your experiments. Next person on the list was... Does somebody have a further comment?
Should I have a question? You were talking about heat, and you said approximately one square meter of the human body in the sunny day is exposed to 1.2 sun energy. So I calculated that for the whole body, 1.9, it would be approximately 2,280 watts. And you didn't mention about time frame.
Okay, you're misquoting me a little bit there, Wes. The solar energy hitting the Earth is either 1,200 or 1,300 watts per square meter. That's the amount of solar flux density. That's how much the sun is pouring onto the Earth, 1,200 or 1,300 watts per square meter. A human being projects an area of roughly half a square meter.
Nine.
You said 0.9? Okay, if you want.
1.9 square meter.
That may be the total area of all of your skin. Not all of that skin is aimed toward the sun. The shadow you create onto your blanket when the sun is shining on you, the shadow you create on your blanket is closer to half a square meter. Over to you, Wes.
It's correct, actually. The part of the light that is reflected is also hitting the body. So actually, we're talking about approximately 1.9 divided by 2 plus 1/4. But you didn't mention about time frame. So we're talking about, just curiosity, time frame for absorbing the energy.
In the case of RF energy, you integrate for 6 minutes. When it comes to solar energy, there's a whole lot of other variables involved here now. Is a normal amount of water in your body? Are you sweating at the normal rate? Is the wind blowing to create some evaporation? So under normal conditions, I think you can thermally tolerate the sun shining on you for an hour. I didn't say that's going to be safe as far as sunburn is concerned, but when it comes to your body tolerating that half a kilowatt or a little bit more of heat that you're going to absorb, your body can tolerate that for a solid hour, as long as you're not getting sunburned. Over to you, West, N2XJN, KQRIW.
In terms of radio frequency, any good contact or skin depth is proportional to the square root of resistivity. For 60 hertz, usually is 8.5 millimeters. And Ham KL7AJ did an experiment. I'm gonna read it. I used to demonstrate the human light bulb. Well, the human wire, anyway. Let me jump. I'd set up 1,000 watt ham radio transmitter to operate at about 14 megahertz at a couple hundred watts. I'd have a wire coming from the antenna terminal. I'd grab the threaded part of the heat lamp and I'd touch the button part of the base to the transmitter wire. The bulb would light up fully, my hand being half the circuit. Never felt a thing unless I did grab the base tight enough, in which case I got nasty burn.
Almost any ham radio operator who's done a whole lot of experimenting over the years has gotten himself an RF burn. At the end of a piece of coax cable, which has got, let me pick a number, 20 watts flowing into it, and you touch the center conductor and your finger bridges the gap between the center conductor and the shield. Over that tiny fraction of a square centimeter, you'll develop an RF burn. So you can easily concentrate the RF energy over an extremely small section of the human body and you get an RF burn. And is that heating your whole body, creating a dangerous condition? No. That piece of skin that you just burned is going to be uncomfortable. It's going to have a white lump of dead flesh there for a short period of time. Not significant. We've all done that. But whole body exposure to RF energy, as long as you keep it under a couple of milliwatts per square centimeter, which is around 1,000 watts per square meter, evenly distributed over the human body, and you integrate for 6 minutes, that's a safe condition if you keep it below those numbers. So the average HF antenna that Bob's going to be operating, as long as it's some number like 5 or 10 feet from him. I think he's going to be safe. Okay, I'm going to go over to Joe now. Joe is the next person on the list. I'm A2RYY, K2RIW. Go ahead, Joe. K2RIW listening.
Okay, good evening, Dick. How you doing? I have a antenna I'm going to be using on 6 meters, so I'm going to be putting up as soon as the weather breaks a little bit. And it's called a monopole. It resembles a ground plane, and the top element folds over and grounds to the base where the radios go. This antenna, in a commercial range, it's a 4250 antenna, which of course I shorten the elements a little bit to get it resonated about 52.5 approximately. When I tuned it up years and years ago, I remember when I did a network analyzer, I got a return loss on center frequency of something like about minus 22, 23, and I had the antenna up about maybe 10 feet above the ground, just propped on a ladder. You just keep it off the ground a little bit. Is there any way of predicting how much the return loss will go by going, like, say, 2 megahertz away? Because the manufacturer specs, they say the antenna has a 250 kilohertz bandwidth. And I guess they mean it. My radio timed out. Is there any way of predicting what the return loss would be at, like, say 1.5 to 2 megahertz away in either direction, primarily lower than not higher, where the commercial specification is 250 kilohertz bandwidth, and I'm not sure what they if they go, like, by 10% reflected power with those figures, 15% reflected power, like 1.5 is worth, something like that. I'm not sure. But is there any way, if you knew that, is there any way of predicting by going like 2 megahertz away what the return loss would actually be? I guess it would be quite a bit different. A lot, you'd have a lot more reflective power, but is it predictable?
The long ID. I wish we could use only the short ID here, which is legal during the net. Yes, to a mild degree, you can make a pretty good prediction as to what impedance you're going to be getting by way of the Brown and Woodward curve, by way of the two, mic number one and mic number two websites. Mic number one is www.amateurradio.tangovictor. That's mic number one. Mic number two is LimeLockTechNet.com. In either of those, mic number one was KC2NJI, Mike Perry. Mic number two is K1MJM. Either one of those websites will give you the Brown and Woodward curves. Way back in 1945 or so, Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward, I think they worked at Bell Labs, took every reasonable diameter of quarter wave piece of wire, every reasonable diameter and reasonable length, and measures the resistive component and the reactive component. Can we drop? So your quarter wave ground plane on 6 meters has a known diameter of its wire and a known length. By way of those curves, you look first at the resistive curve and then the reactive curve. The reactive curve is the significant one. You'll find that when you go from quarter wave long, it's 90 degrees, and you go to some other frequency where it's 80 degrees long, those curves will tell you exactly what reactive impedance you're going to get and what resistive impedance. With a little bit of mathematics, you can turn that R number and the X number, R plus JX, if you know what I mean, you can convert that into standing wave ratio. I could give you the formula for that, but I think you know what the process is, Joe. Tell me if you need any more information on that. So Brown and Woodward will give you a 90% accuracy prediction as to what impedance you're going to get out of that antenna when you tune to some other frequency. When the manufacturer tells you its bandwidth, is he talking about the 3 dB bandwidth, the 50% reflection, the 10% reflection? 50% reflected power is something like a 5.8:1 standing wave ratio. Is that what he's using? Each of them uses a different definition. It's hard to know what that really means. Over to you, Joe. W2RYY, K2RIW in TechNet. Wait for all four beeps in 1 second.
I don't know. I just remember seeing that by looking up the antenna on the internet, as far as, you know, by the model number and come up with some sort of information. as far as you know, what he had, what these specifications were. It felt like a tuning chart, and I just remember seeing that on most of the commercial frequencies, 40 to 50, it just said 250 kilohertz bandwidth, but they didn't, you know, they didn't give me any other information other than that. I guess it probably means maybe at points 125 kilohertz away. Either way, maybe you've got 10% reflective power compared to the ideal condition where it's you know, right on the money. Okay, I thought it was maybe a little easier to predict something like that, but maybe not.
Yeah, 10% reflective power. I think that's a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. However, it becomes a little bit academic. Is it 250 kc of bandwidth or 300 kc of bandwidth? When you start getting to the edge of the bandwidth, the curve of reactance versus frequency starts rising very fast. So what they use as a definition becomes a little bit academic. As I said, if he thinks it's 250 kc of bandwidth, and you do a measurement and you think it's 300 kc of bandwidth, that's a rather small percentage of difference, because the curve of reactance versus frequency is rising so fast, it almost doesn't matter. If the antenna has got 250 kc of bandwidth, and you're using it on 80 meters, where the hold-on band is 500 kc wide, you know you're still going to cover only a small fraction of the band. W2RYY,
K2RIW, go ahead, Joe. No other questions on it. Go over to the next guy or whatever. I guess I'll have to put it up and give it a check it with a return loss bridge and actually see what I get it on the other frequencies I intend to use, at least listen on, possibly. I don't know if I can transmit, because I'm using it. It's going to be 52.5 megahertz for FM. But I want to also use it off the same radio around 50.1 for SSB. I just don't know, you know, if it's going to get, like, you know, 6-to-1 SWR or higher. They might be get to the point where the radio can't tolerate it anymore. I guess it's hard to predict with you know, all these formulas and so forth and looking at charts. Thanks, W2YY.
Okay, you've got the instrumentation where you can make those measurements, Joe, and report back to us. Okay, we go down the list of people who signed in. I think Rich said he had one more question. N2EL, K2RIW, go ahead, Rich. Okay, now it's time we go over to Roy, EC2GS, who is going to possibly give us more information on special relativity and general relativity. Possibly he's going to discuss scalar waves. By the way, there's strong evidence that scalar waves on RF transmission do not exist. There's strong evidence of that. Even though people want there to be something called scalar waves with a hell of a lot less loss and all kinds of great advantages, it doesn't exist, in my opinion. But for people who want to believe it, Dr. Roy, EC2GS, with Science and Physics. Go right ahead, sir. K2RIW and TechNet.
WB3HWW with a comment on the last subject trying to get in, but it's hearing me.
Right now, I'm not hearing Dr. Roy. HWW, go right ahead. You got it.
Okay, two things, Dick. When you, most manufacturers, when they give you bandwidth, they're looking at a 2-to-1 SWR. That's what they're looking at. So take the 2-to-1 and it's 11% return. Whatever that comes out to is 11%, whatever that is, return loss to DB, that would be your bandwidth. Another thing, most commercial antennas, I think that monopole that Joe was talking about is DC grounded. Like a trombone, if you look at a trombone type antenna, because it's DC grounded, the quarter wave and it's bent over, that's going to give you a lot of higher return loss, because as you get out of resonance, you start to short out. So the difference between a half wave dipole or a quarter wave ground plane, you know, it's not DC grounded, you're going to find a sharper resonance to that. But if you look at manufacturers, when they talk about bandwidth, they're telling you at the 2-to-1. Some will specify 1.5-to-1 SWR. Back to you, Dick.
The so-called Brown and Woodward curves that I talk about so often, where they predict the exact resistive component and reactive component of the impedance of an antenna when you know the diameter of the wire and the length, that's a quarter wave ground plane. In other words, they made measurements with an extremely large sheet of metal as the counterpoise, and then the piece of wire in the middle of that sheet of metal. You can take a full half-wave dipole, any half-wave dipole, and put a sheet of metal down the center at right angles to the wire, and it'll make no change of the impedance, the antenna, gain, pattern, whatever. And so a dipole is really a pair of ground plane antennas back to back. So in a symmetric antenna like a dipole, the Brown and Woodward curves give you an exact answer. When it comes to a quarter wave ground plane antenna, or a J-pole, or some of these other antennas where you've got a more mysterious counterpoise, the Brown and Woodward curves will give you a partial answer that's going to be a little bit optimistic. Let me drop. Because as you go off frequency, not only is your radiator becoming more reactive, but what you're using as a ground plane, a counterpoise, which probably was ground plane radials or something like that, which is another resonance structure, that also is going off resonance. In the case of a typical ground plane antenna with the three ground plane radials, they really are the other half of the dipole that you split the long way into three pieces and bent them nearly at a right angle. So I still think that the Brown and Woodward curves are going to give you a pretty good answer. Not perfect, but at least it's going to be a ballpark. And yes, I think many manufacturers use 2-to-1 standing wave ratio as the definition of bandwidth. And that's where you've got 11% power reflected, which is something like a 9.5 dB reflection coefficient. So most of them do that, not all of them. Some of them will go to the half power point, which is really a 5.8 standing wave ratio. Over to you for any further comments on this, Howie. WB2HWW, K2RIW in the Tech Man.
I agree with you on the curve, but Dick is talking about, Joe was talking about, some of these commercial antennas are DC grounded. Yeah, they have a ground plane, but they basically use more than one plane, the other end is shorted. So if you get between the hot and ground between the center conductor and the shield, you're going to see a DC ground. That's not the lightning connection. Because the antenna is a DC grounded antenna, or shunting, that's going, as you go out of resonance, as you go to the edge of the band, you're now going, it's going to give you a much higher SWR than you would if it wasn't. You understand what I'm saying? You have an antenna that is DC shorted, both for lightning protection and to reduce it for noise. So when you look at an antenna, might be using an old band. That's, you know, I feel like I have a 10 vertical that DC ground commercial antenna. You have a DC grounded antenna, that makes a big difference because you're going to get a higher SQ. Because the capacitor reaction is going to increase much faster.
Yeah, we're hearing most of what you're saying. You're dropping out every half second or so for a quarter of a second. There's a whole lot of dropouts of your speech. But the word DC ground you keep talking about, RF-wise, yes, it makes a difference. But the so-called DC ground, which might be a water pipe, the water pipe itself, depending on how it's laid out in your house, could be an inductive link, which gives you some other mysterious effects. Still, those Brown and Woodward curves will give you a ballpark figure as to what you're going to get for bandwidth. Not a perfect answer, but a 50% accurate answer is a hell of a lot better than none at all, if you know what I mean. And lots of ham radio operators think there's something magic about making sure your antenna is grounded as far as RF performance is concerned. For symmetric antennas, I'm convinced that Mike